Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ash Carter knows the U.S. Defense Department very well. He was number three there, he was number two there, and from 2015 to 2017, Ash Carter was number one there, U.S. Secretary of Defense, a physicist and reform agent at the top of the world's most potent military. Now he's watching as a new administration deals with Iran, North Korea, Russia, China, ISIS. This hour on Point, former Defense Secretary Ash Carter on the state of the world. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your question for the man who, until January, headed up the Pentagon? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. He's been there, literally there. This was November 2015, then Secretary of Defense Ash Carter in South Korea in the DMZ talking about deterrence and North Korea's nuclear path.
The ever-present danger is the reason why we speak of the ability to fight tonight. That's the slogan up here. No one ever wants to have to do that. But deterrence is guaranteed through strength, and that's what the alliance is all about.
But could it happen? His successor, Secretary of Defense, former General James Mattis, is in that seat right now, a hot seat right now. On Monday, here was Mattis speaking at the Association of the U.S. Army Convention in Washington, saying, be ready.
Now, what does the future hold? Neither you nor I can say. So there's one thing the U.S. Army can do, and that is you have got to be ready to ensure that we have military options that our president can employ if needed.
James Mattis now holds the reins. Ash Carter held them until January. He joins me in the studio. He served in the Obama administration as Secretary of Defense until the handover to Mattis early this year. From 09 to 11, he was Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics. From 2011 to 2013, he was Defense's Deputy Secretary and Chief Operating Officer. Now, Ash Carter is Professor of Technology and Global Affairs at Harvard, Director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's out with a new report on the fight against ISIS, headlined A Lasting Defeat, the campaign to destroy ISIS. Ash Carter, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be here with you, Tom.
What do you make of the North Korea situation right now? There's James Mattis, your successor, talking with officers of the Army this week and saying, be ready. Is there still a chance for a diplomatic solution here?
There may be a chance, but Jim Mattis is right, and we've been doing that since 1953, standing strong on the DMZ. Until we're able to turn around North Korea on its ballistic missile and nuclear programs and other provocations, which I'll get to in a moment, deterrence and defense are what we do to protect our people, which we have to do. Deterrence is what Jim spoke about. I spoke about when we cite the slogan on the DMZ, which is fight tonight. We are
ready.
We and South Korean forces both to protect Seoul and South Korea and then to turn the tide and destroy the North Korean military and destroy the North Korean regime. I'm confident we could do that. I'm confident that North Korea understands that we can do that. However, you should be clear, Tom, that war on the Korean Peninsula is unlike anything humankind has seen since the last Korean War. It is intense combat.
It was a meat grinder in the Korean War.
Yes, and now, South Korea is much more densely populated. The war takes place in the northern suburbs of Seoul, which are populated. Artillery rains down on Seoul, and until we can destroy those artillery pieces, there's a great deal of loss of life. And in addition to deterrence, we have defenses in anticipation that North Korea might do what it has done, namely to build ballistic missiles of longer range and to develop nuclear weapons. We began some years ago, this was when I was undersecretary, to deploy missile defenses of the United States. We have them now. They're quite capable. So deterrence and defense are there, but you asked about negotiations and the possibility of negotiations. I've actually negotiated with the North Koreans back in the 1990s, a very strange experience. I went to Pyongyang in 1999, and we had some temporary success there. And it's possible that one can do that again, but here's how. And I hope that this is what Jim Mattis and Rex Tillerson are about and able to pull off. You know, Tom, you turn on the television and there are commentators talking about the options for our president in North Korea, and it's either war or diplomacy. In the real world, you mix the military and the diplomatic.
You mean the carrot and stick, threat and...
Yes, and it's coercive diplomacy in which you tie steps you take to apply pressure to things that you demand of North Korea. It's important to apply pressure to them, but we also need to make it clear what we want them to do.
And but let me ask you something, if I may, Secretary Carter, Ash Carter, because that hasn't worked. They've proceeded. Presumably, we've been applying this general formula now for some years. You wrote more than a decade ago now, you were in favor of striking a North Korean missile test when the missile was ready to launch. On the pad in the north, you said we should take it out with a Tomahawk or some kind of cruise missile. You said if we don't do it now, it's only going to get more difficult. It's only going to get worse. We didn't do it then, and now here we are. North Korea's nuclear capacity fairly well demonstrated. Still lots we don't know about the complete sophistication of it. But how do you deal with the situation that has gone forward from what you warned? You said take this one out now as a demonstration. We didn't do it. Now here we are. They've got nukes and they've got missiles flying far. How does coercive diplomacy work in that situation?
In fact, it goes back even further, my own history, back to 1994 when I did the very first strike plan for the reactor at Yongbyon, which was going to, for the first time, produce plutonium. We were ready to do that. I was capable that that plan would succeed. In the end, it did not. Was not necessary to carry that out, and here's why. And this shows that from time to time, coercive diplomacy has worked. You're right that over a quarter of century, on the whole, it has not stopped North Korea. Three generations now, Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and now Kim Jong-un, from going forward. But in the 1990s, we had for a period of several years where their plutonium program was frozen and their missile tests were halted through coercive diplomacy. And then again during the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, that is, there was under Colin Powell for a couple of years some success as well. So I'm not saying that this will work, but we have had some experience.
But hasn't the game changed now, Ash Carter, with their nuclear capacity? It's just different. It's greater. They've shown it. They've done the nuclear test. We've seen it. They've let the missiles fly. We've seen it. You've got many people saying, I mean, Steve Bannon was strategic advisor to the president. He said, no way you can do war on the Korean Peninsula. The death toll is just too high. And others saying, you've got to let them, at this point, they're going to have nuclear weapons. Get used to it.
I think it's very hard for us to get used to North Korea having nuclear weapons. This is not Leonid Brezhnev's USSR, where you can expect a stable situation if North Korea persists in these nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that Kim Jong-un wants to survive, for sure, but he needs also to constantly prove to his people that he's in charge and that he is leading them forward. And therefore, I am not in the camp of people who believes that if North Korea has nuclear weapons and we simply leave them alone, it will just settle down. Therefore, I think that we need to persist with deterrence and defense and give coercive diplomacy a shot. Now, let's play that forward a little bit. It might work in the sense of slowing and then reversing their ballistic missile and nuclear programs. That's the best case. if after that effort it doesn't work, we will have prepared ourselves, our South Korean allies and our Japanese allies, which are inevitably part of this terrible
war. Right there.
And we will have sidelined the Chinese by showing that what has been true for the last 25 years is their unwillingness to use their influence to stop the Chinese from going forward. That positions us better for a dire circumstance if that actually occurs.
President Trump last week talked about the calm before the storm. Is that where we are with North Korea? Is there a storm coming? Is this thing baked in the cake already?
It's hard to know what his statements mean. I do watch what Secretary Mattis and Secretary Tillerson say they're trying to do, which I interpret to be exactly what I'm saying, which is to give coercive diplomacy that is very intentional, step-by-step diplomacy, a chance here. It might work, and if it doesn't, it better positions us for a strong response to North Korea if that proves necessary.
Can we really go to war here? Wouldn't that we're told that the it's a terrible phrase, but the butcher's bill in South Korea could be hundreds of thousands in fairly short order, with Seoul sitting right on the DMZ.
Well, that's not going to be our choice. It's going to be North Korea's choice. And so deterrence is about making it less likely that they actually start that war, which you're absolutely right, would be a war like the world has not seen since the last Korean War.
Are you sure they would start it? What if they – I mean, I don't know what you mean by start it, but we've sort of got red lines out there now about, you know, if they have nuclear weapons on missiles, that could do this or that.
I think if that what's very clear to North Korea is that if North Korea attacks the United States or our friends and allies, that the United States will respond militarily and that a war on the Korean Peninsula will result in their defeat. We recognize that that is a very undesirable war to wage. On the other hand, I am confident that we will win it.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, everyone. This is Tom. Just a quick message before we get back to the show. I'm inviting you to stick around at the end of this podcast for an excerpt from another NPR show, Only a Game. Here's why. This weekend, Only a Game is examining power and corruption at the NCAA after the FBI arrested 10 people, including 4 college basketball coaches, for allegedly accepting bribes. College players and their families are vulnerable. Listen for a sneak preview of Only a Game's episode, Power, Money, and Corruption, the Exploitation of College Athletes, at the end of our show. We're talking with former U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at the country's military and security challenges right now. The challenges facing the Trump administration. Ash Carter is with me in the studio. It has been a fairly wild time, certainly in terms of rhetoric and threats. In his speech at the UN in September, President Trump threatened to take down North Korea.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
That in the UN. Just in the last week, we've heard the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Bob Corker, talking kind of dire terms about the path that the country may be getting on. Here he was in a telephone interview with New York Times reporter Jonathan Martin, Tennessee Republican Senator Bob Corker, talking about the potential international ramifications of the president's comments and tweets.
Sometimes I feel like he's on a reality show of some kind, you know, when he's talking about these big foreign policy issues. And, you know, he doesn't realize that, you know, that we could be heading towards World War III with the kind of comments that he's making.
And this from Bob Corker on what stands between, he says, the country and chaos.
Secretary Tillerson, Secretary Mattis, and Chief of Staff Kelly are those people that help separate our country from chaos.
Ashton Carter has been right there in the seat that James Mattis now holds at the head of the Pentagon. He's now at Harvard's Belfer Center at the Kennedy School, and with us in the studio today, you can join the conversation. What's your question for the former defense secretary? Would you want to be the officer charged with carrying out a nuclear attack order from Donald Trump? Should we be decertifying the Iran nuclear deal? That is big this week, as President Trump apparently wants to do. What's your question? Right across the world, Iran, North Korea, ISIS, Russia, China. Can we talk about Iran and ISIS?
Sure.
I want to look at that, but Iran first. This is the week, tomorrow, we're told, the president will announce his position on decertifying or certifying or decertifying whether Iran is upholding its end of the bargain on the nuclear deal. James Mattis has said publicly that he believes they are and that we should stick with the deal. The president, not so clear on that. How do you look at this fork in the road?
Well, I do think that the Iran deal is a good deal in the sense that it does what it was intended to do. That is, verifiably, and I think it is being verified, block Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. However, it also needs to be said that the Iran deal never was and could never have been a grand bargain with Iran. We still have serious problems with Iran. Iran is still the death to America country. It threatens our friends and allies in the Gulf. And so my instructions after the Iran deal, nuclear deal, was concluded.
From President Obama, this is.
I'm sorry, the instructions I gave my department with the approval of President Obama is it didn't change anything we were doing. We keep tens of thousands of people in the Gulf to deter Iran and protect our friends and allies. We have missile defenses there. We work with the State of Israel to protect it from Iran. And we work against all of Iran's malign activities, whether they be Hezbollah in Lebanon, their meddling in Iraq and Syria, where we've been fighting ISIL and they have not been on the right side of that, and elsewhere around the world. So I think one needs to keep in perspective that this is not a grand bargain with Iran. That said, it does take off the table the capability that would be most disturbing were Iran to get it, nuclear weapons. It does that verifiably, and therefore it is worth sticking with.
How do you see the ramifications? If the president decertifies and says, despite the attestations of his defense secretary now and others, European allies in this, if he says, no, I'm not going to certify that Iran's following the rules here, and Congress follows up on that, tries to reimpose some sanctions, you're not responsible for the whole of this as a defense secretary, but militarily, what are the implications of that?
Well, militarily, letting Iran have a nuclear weapon, it very much complicates our position in the Gulf and our ability to defend our friends and allies. So it's a setback.
Do you think decertifying puts us on the road to them having a nuclear weapon?
Well, we'll have to see what actions Congress takes. What I hope is that this expression of concern about Iran ends there, and that in fact we do not take apart an agreement which is having a very important effect at protecting us and our allies. And by the way, it is odd at the same time we are very understandably, as you and I were discussing, concerned about North Korea's nuclear program and very much regretting the history of the last 25 years as this state, also an avowed enemy of ours, has steadily moved to nuclear weapons to allow Iran to begin down the very same path.
And decertifying, you would see as a step toward them getting back on that path.
It is, but there are many steps that remain, and so I hope that it doesn't lead to the unraveling of something which is in our national security interest.
You're guessing or hoping, I'm hearing, that even if the president decertifies, Congress would not follow up on that with the concrete actions that would suspend the sanctions.
Yeah, and that would, if
or reimpose, I should say.
Yes, and that would save the substance of the agreement, and the president would have expressed himself about his concerns about Iran and his longstanding opposition to this agreement. But it would end there, and we wouldn't so to speak, cut off our nose to spite our face here and interrupt an agreement that is serving U.S. national security interests and our friends and allies.
Ash Carter, can we talk about ISIS, or ISIL, as you say? I'm reading headlines here saying, this is from just a couple of days ago, Islamic State nearly expelled from its last urban stronghold in Iraq. Here's another headline just a couple of days ago, ISIS fighters surrendering en masse. Now, you know, we've got a long history here, and there have been times in the past when we sort of thought maybe the tide has turned, maybe they're going down. What about this time? How do you assess? You were very active in U.S. strategy here and operations carrying it out against ISIS or ISIL. How do you assess where we stand now?
Well, what you see in Raqqa today, Raqqa in Syria, and what you saw in Mosul and Iraq were the expelling of ISIL from the two principal cities that it said allowed it to claim that there was an Islamic State based upon this ideology. We can't have an Islamic State based upon this barbarism. We needed to destroy that, and it was necessary to destroy it in Mosul and destroy it in Raqqa. That is the military campaign plan we put together 2 years ago and that you have seen steadily unfolding and that culminated earlier in this year in the taking of Mosul and is culminating now in the taking of Raqqa.
That is culminating now. Please be more specific about that. I mean, that's in Syria.
In Syria, and that Raqqa, which is a town most Americans, of course, have never even heard of.
Yeah, but the putative capital of the Islamic State.
Yes, it's what they said was the capital of their so-called state. And so it had enormous symbolic value, and it had practical value as well.
Because doesn't it there were still? People isn't it Raqqa, still? I'm sorry. Forgive me.
It's important that Americans know that there were people in Raqqa. It was there that most of the plots were hatched, where they were trying to inspire Americans and direct Americans to kill other Americans and also Europeans as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our job
as the Department of Defense join the movement
is to protect our people. And we needed to protect our people. And to do that, we needed to get into Raqqa and kill them or expel them. That has now been done. And this is a great success for the U.S. military. You really have to salute what we have done. Now, we did it with the help of local forces, which was the strategy. Because remember, we've had the experience of conquering places ourselves.
Yep.
Then you have to govern them. And
that's tough.
Exactly. And so we have worked in the painful and demands a lot of patience to work with the Iraqi forces, the Kurdish Peshmerga, Syrian Defense Forces we're working with in Syria. But it's necessary in order to make defeat of ISIS stick. And now my concern at this point, Tom, is less the military campaign, and I salute my successor, Jim Mattis, who's mm-hmm. a good friend of mine. I've known mm-hmm. him for 20 years, mm-hmm. for continuing the campaign, mm-hmm. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joe Dunford, mm-hmm. And bringing it to this point. My concern at this stage is less with the military side than with the political and economic side, because if the people who live in Mosul and mm-hmm. Raqqa mm-hmm. don't, as a consequence, they're glad, and we know this, to be free of these barbarians, many of whom are foreigners, not mm-hmm. local people at all, people from Russia and China and Europe and elsewhere, who got all jazzed up mm-hmm. with the idea they were going to join an Islamic State, many of them sociopaths. And they're glad to be free of their rule. At the same time, they need to see their lives improve, or again, extremism will be able to take hold in Syria and Iraq. So we need to do the economic and political follow-up. But I think this is a moment when Americans ought to look proudly at the performance of their military and their country. No other country could have put together a coalition like this. No other country could have led to a victory like this.
And of course, is ISIL actually vanquished?
Well, you can't say it is a major, major advance to have them expelled from Mosul, the second largest mm-hmm. city in Iraq,
yep.
and from their putative capital in Raqqa. Mm-hmm. It's a great advance to have many of them killed. It's a great advance to have the narrative punctured that there's going to be an Islamic State. But there's still some of them who survive. They're heading down the Euphrates Valley now. Mm-hmm. We will pursue them, attempt to kill them there.
That is toward Baghdad.
Yeah. Yes. And then you always have to worry, and this is what the FBI and Homeland Security and so forth do, about the American at his keyboard who's never been anywhere but is incited to violence by this. Now, that becomes, I think, less likely because no one sitting at a keyboard in the United States can possibly believe that there is a successful Islamic State that they're operating on. But at the same time, people are sociopaths and they have firearms and so forth.
Sure
they
do.
They can go out, and that's where law enforcement and Homeland Security are still going to be important.
What about the Islamic State turning outward if they lose and have lost territory in the region? We've always been told they may turn to terrorism abroad, maybe even here.
Well, they've been determined to carry out terrorist acts in the United States, and destroying their nests and the places from which they could stably plot makes it more difficult for them to attack the United States. They do aspire, Tom, to going other places, Libya, Southeast Asia. There are little nests of ISIS in Afghanistan. And I used to talk about the cancer of ISIS and its parent tumor being in Iraq and Syria, but there were metastases as well. It's necessary for us, and of course we did expel ISIS from Sirte in Libya last year. You know that the President Trump made a decision to remain in Afghanistan and, in fact, slightly increase the troop numbers there. That's a decision I support. I recommended to President Obama when I was secretary that we not leave Afghanistan, and actually a slight increase also then in our troop numbers. So this is something we need to stick with.
Let's go to our callers. Bob in Montreal. Bob, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Mr. Secretary, pleasure to share the air with you. This week, the Saudi king visited Russia and met with President Putin. I think this is the first time such a diplomatic happening took place. And apparently they did a lot of business in the defense or arms industry. The Saudis bought some equipment from the Russians. My question to you, sir, is, it seems that President Putin has more sway and clout in the Middle East than ever before, and I'm wondering how you read that in terms of U.S. influence in the Middle East, in the region.
Well, I read Vladimir Putin. People often ask me, what is Vladimir Putin thinking? And, of course, I've dealt with him for many years now, and I say you don't have to wonder what he's thinking. He tells you what he's thinking. And he does want to play a stronger hand in the world. And above all, he wants to thwart the United States. He sets that as a specific objective, which makes it so hard to deal with Vladimir. In general, I'm in favor of talking with other powers, including those who may be our opponents. But if somebody's specific objective is to frustrate you, it's a little hard to build a bridge to that objective. That has been his objective. In the Middle East, your question, he came into Syria. His defense minister called me to say that they intended to fight ISIS and to move Assad out of Syria. Move Assad aside, as he said.
That hasn't happened.
Neither. They didn't fight ISIS either. So the two things they said they were going to do, they didn't do. Instead, they fueled the civil war in Syria and buttressed Assad, and they did nothing. It is we who've defeated ISIS. Russia had nothing to do with it. And yes, you'll see them flirting with the Saudis. I think it's pretty clear that we are the partner of choice for Saudi Arabia. They have nowhere else to go. And so I'm not too concerned to see them talking to the Russians. I think fundamentally the Saudis need the United States. They recognize they need the United States, and we have been a good friend and supporter for them.
Are you supportive of the Trump administration's President Trump's friendly warmth toward Vladimir Putin and the Russians?
I don't think it's warranted, and I don't think it's actually going anywhere, because if you think about it, there is no rapprochement ongoing with Russia. I don't think that would be supported in this country. I think it's made more difficult by the widespread recognition that Russia's not only been opposing the United States abroad but meddled in our democratic process. That's incontrovertible proof of that. And so that's not happening. There is no rapprochement with Russia, I don't think.
Does it matter then when the president has said on the campaign trail and beyond, has talked about his admiration for Vladimir Putin and talked about, does that matter?
It has not been translated into a change of policy, and I'm glad of that because I don't think Vladimir Putin deserves that. I don't mind people talking to the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, Iran, but you need to understand what you're dealing with in with Russia. And this is a country, whether it's been in Ukraine or in the Middle East or with respect to brandishing of nuclear weapons and its buildup of its nuclear arsenal or meddling in the U.S. democratic process, has been hostile to the United States. And that's the Russia that we reckon with, and that's the Russia that we need to deal with. And that seems to be the case, notwithstanding what the president-elect said months ago.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with former U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter about the country's military and security challenges right now, the challenges facing the Trump administration. Ashton Carter was Secretary of Defense from 2015 until the handover to the Trump administration and General James Mattis earlier this year. He joins me in the studio right now, and you can join us as well. Dana is calling from New Britain, Connecticut. Dana, you're on the air with Ash Carter.
Hi, Tom. This is Dana. I just wanted to say quickly, I am a Trump voter, and aside from destroying ISIS in Raqqa, which is something that Trump did promise to do on the campaign trail, I got to say these drumbeats towards war for North Korea and Iran is absolute insanity. It's not what we need. It's not what the world needs. We're still reeling from the $1 trillion-plus wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the thousands dead and wounded, and you know, this is absolutely insane. It's crazy to even think about not one but two wars, and it just reflects the control the neoconservatives still have over our foreign policy.
Well, is it what your candidate promised you, Dana, as a voter? You support Trump. Is it what you thought you had coming from this president if he was elected?
No, it's not. I thought we were getting America first and staying out of these foreign theaters and, you know, sticking to ourselves unless we're attacked. And it seems like they're trying to manufacture crises and create these conditions for justification of starting all kinds of new wars.
Dana, I appreciate your call. Ash Carter, do you feel, I mean, a lot of Americans look at the threats, the language, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is saying we're at risk of being put on a path to World War III, and do feel exactly this high level of concern that, in fact, we may be close to some significant armed conflict here. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, even though I've been my entire life charged with defending our country, and I believe very deeply in that mission, Dana has a point, which is that there is a frustration, and this is one of the things that I share and that I'm working on right now in our country with the feeling that progress, particularly technological progress, isn't serving the entirety of the population, and that there's some people whose lives are disrupted and who are left behind. And
how does that relate to the fear of war that Dana's expressing?
Well,
Dana
is saying that he was looking for someone who would look more towards America's problems at home.
Yeah.
I wish we were able to do it either or. I'm just acknowledging that Dana's right. We have things here at home that we need to pay attention to. And I realize people, and I understood this, and I heard a lot of that when I was Secretary of Defense, fatigue with being overseas. At the same time, I have to say we need to protect ourselves. It's a dangerous world out there. And we do have Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, ISIS, other terrorist organizations, and we simply have to protect ourselves. So I understand that we need to do more at home, and I share much of Dana's belief that there's work to be done at home. At the same time, I think, without getting us into every conflict that we could conceivably have. We do need to stand strong and protect ourselves. I've already said in North Korea that I favor a path of giving coercive diplomacy a chance and a caution, which it sounds like our caller shares, with the price of a war there, which would be far greater than anything we did in Iraq or Afghanistan.
What about the characterization of the Obama administration, which you served? It's reflected in this comment from a listener. Question to Ash Carter: did Obama's policy of appeasement succeed regarding Russia, China, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Syria, Cuba, and Venezuela? That word appeasement, that's a Trump kind of characterization of what came before. And you hear this listener saying, well, was that it?
Let's see. Let's just walk around the world there. Mm-hmm. With respect to Russia, President Obama supported NATO, supported standing strong, mm-hmm. our buildup of our own forces in Europe, which I led, mm-hmm. and didn't fall for what they were doing in Syria. With respect
to the Russians.
China, the mm-hmm. Russians. With mm-hmm. respect to China, President Obama supported me again in a buildup of our forces, the so-called rebalance. We've put mm-hmm. our newest and best stuff out there. With respect to North Korea, we have 28,500 troops. There was no diminution in those number of troops, and we've improved them very greatly qualitatively. With respect to Iran, President Obama did conclude the Iran nuclear deal, which, as I've said, actually is in our interest because it takes off the table one of the things that Iran could use to threaten us and our friends and allies. And then finally, with respect to ISIS, the campaign that I talked about earlier, which is culminating now and resulting in the defeat of ISIS in Mosul in Iraq, was one that I and Joe Dunford recommended to President Obama, and he consistently approved. And I never, when I asked him for more in Iraq, even though we all recognize this is someone who did not want to be in a war mm-hmm. in Iraq. That's mm-hmm. not what he ran on. Mm-hmm. He nevertheless approved every single request that General Dunford and I made. So that's kind of a walk around the mm-hmm. world.
Mm-hmm. Carol in New Orleans. Carol, you're on the air with Ash Carter. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for the pleasure of speaking to someone who really knows the workings of government. But my question is, the allies that we have in Europe, like particularly Angela Merkel, has stated that, you know, the European countries are now pretty much their destiny is on the, left to themselves. They don't trust this president. They know he's not competent. They know he's not stable. How can we be such a great power in the world and continue to be that when you have this instability in our own country, someone who doesn't understand the complexities of the world? And then he touts off all the and physically abusive to other world leaders. I mean, this is a bizarre situation for our country.
Ash Carter?
Well, I think that there are people in the United States who think that alliances, which we have with our NATO countries, are a gift that America gives to foreigners. They're not. They're one of the ways we get what we want. And so by working with Europe, we help protect ourselves, first of all, against Russia. And that's what the NATO alliance was born for. And now in recent years, we have had to recreate NATO as essentially a bulwark against Russia. And also NATO works with us in Afghanistan and has worked with us in fighting ISIS. So if you look around the world and you say, where are there people who are kind of like us? They share some of our values of civilization and decency and respect for people and respect for the world order. Europe is one of those places where – so I think they're valuable partners and allies. At the same time, I am in a long line of American leaders, and our current president is one also, who have complained that the Europeans don't do enough in their defense. So I had that same view. I told the Europeans very bluntly they needed to do more. At the same time, I believe that the NATO alliance is in our interest, and you really have to look, spin a globe sometime and ask yourself, where are there people who share the values of Western civilization? They're certainly not at ISIS, and currently in Moscow and Beijing, certainly not in Pyongyang or Tehran. So we need to keep our friends.
Has President Trump's attitude damaged those alliances?
I can't say, Tom, because there's as I talk to foreign leaders around the world, they have stopped paying attention to each and every tweet, and they tend to watch the behavior more. So
what does that mean for American leadership?
It means that we lose an opportunity to inspire others to do what we want to do. So that's clearly a missed opportunity. At the same time, people are looking at what we do and not what we say. And what we do is we continue to have our forces in NATO. We continue to work with NATO. President Trump finally made a statement in which he said that he supported the NATO alliance. So it's not as good as leadership, but the actions are what people are looking at, and less so the words. That's just sadly the situation we find ourselves in.
A listener writes on Twitter, the blanket of diplomacy that covers the whole world with sanity is coming unraveled, and the U.S. is pulling the string now.
Well, the blanket of diplomacy is one of the principal. Obviously, I'm responsible for defense, but I very much respect the diplomatic function. I respect what the State Department does, and it is the principal way that the peace is kept. And
is it coming unraveled?
Well, I think that clarity and consistency and principle are important in American foreign policy. There's no one else who can do what we do. There's no one else who can who could have, for example, led the defeat of ISIS in Mosul and Raqqa.
Are those being delivered now, clarity and principle?
I'd like to see more clarity, consistency, and principle, no question about it. I think we miss an opportunity when we don't have that. Even if people have learned to not pay attention to every tweet, that's not as good as being inspired by the United States. That's the opportunity that we miss, and I hope we can someday return to.
Can we turn to the cyber front? We've heard for years about the U.S. Strengthening its cyber defenses, and yet I sometimes wonder if we've defined them too narrowly. When you describe the Russian intervention in our election, efforts to get right in the middle of that last year. We've seen ongoing reports of espionage, sometimes pretty deep, from China. There's a report I'm reading here, a South Korean legislator saying that North Korea has been reading our battle plans with the South Koreans in case it did come to war on the Korean Peninsula. Are we really taking on the full breadth of cyber threat, or do we have a kind of Maginot Line situation here where we're kind of taking it seriously, but we're still more into tanks and planes and ships, and if push came to shove, we could be disabled digitally?
I don't think we're taking it nearly seriously enough. I believe that in defense, and that is why I was so intent upon improving our cyber defenses. But they're not where they should be. And I never believed our networks were secure. And you see again and again security breaches by the National Security Agency, which is the agency which is supposed to be the most expert at cyber. And then it pervades civil society as well. You see companies being hacked, your personal information being revealed. And then we have the very democratic process, the electoral process. So people should not assume that data is secure, that networks are secure. And I believe as a technological matter now, and as a technologist myself, we are a long way from there.
Do we have a false sense of security then behind our – we got this $700 billion budget for the Pentagon?
If you have a sense of security about cyber protection, it is false. And therefore, for example, I said I simply assumed that our networks were penetrated.
But can you have a real effective defense in place
with that
vulnerability?
Because we planned and we trained people to prevail and continue to fight and to win despite having their networks disrupted. But you need to pay attention to that. So we spent a lot of money, and we need to do more. I'm not saying, Tom, that it's done. On the contrary. We need to do more to protect our networks and strengthen them, but we also need to take into account that we need to protect ourselves even if our networks are vulnerable. And I think individuals need to understand the same thing. When you go on and you give people your personally identifiable information, don't believe that there won't come a day when that might be revealed.
We've just got a couple of minutes left. We've got a lot of people asking about the nuclear, even nuclear exchange fear, a war fear that's in the air these days. Describe for if a president gives the order for a nuclear attack, what happens? And is there a place for a pause before it's actually carried out, or even a resistance to the order?
In our system, only the president of the United States may authorize the use of nuclear weapons. I was number two in the chain of command. I was not authorized to use nuclear weapons.
Were you authorized to slow it or resist it or pause or say, wait a minute, what's Congress think?
In the event that nuclear use was contemplated, I certainly thought and believed that I, as Secretary of Defense, would be on the telephone with the president, that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would be on the telephone, that the Secretary of State, quite possibly the Vice President, the National Security Advisor, and we would all be able to make our views heard.
But if the President says go, could you, as Defense Secretary, now James Mattis role, say no?
I am in the chain of command. And I would try to, if I thought it was a rash act, I would do everything I could to try to talk the president out of that. You always have, as a senior civilian leader, the option of refusing to carry out a presidential order, in which case you need to resign.
And then what happens?
Well, then the Deputy Secretary of Defense becomes the Secretary of Defense. We've been in circumstances like this before, Tom, not about nuclear war, but when presidents, and Richard Nixon did this with his attorney general, gave an order that his attorney general was unwilling to carry out, and the attorney general resigned. But I think that this is why, well before you get to the point where you're on that telephone with the president in that circumstance, you as Secretary of Defense need to help the president to understand his duties better. I hope that is going that is what Jim Mattis, who's an old friend of mine, is doing now, so you don't get to that circumstance where rash decisions could be made.
Ashton Carter, former Defense Secretary of the United States, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for joining
us
today.
Good to be with you always, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for all your questions and comments here. You can continue this conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Hi, it's Tom. Thanks for sticking around for this preview from Only a Game special report, Power, Money, and Corruption, the Exploitation of College Athletes, available this weekend on your NPR station or podcast app.
I'm Bill Littlefield. This week on WBUR and NPR's Only a Game, we dedicate the entire hour to one question: should college athletes be paid?
Maybe you've heard, big-time college sports are in trouble.
Well, it's about as bad as it gets. It's not the NCAA knocking on the door, but the FBI.
The FBI is charging 10 people with fraud and corruption.
We all know this system is corrupt. Every one of us knows it.
If there's going to be a death penalty, it needs to be to amateurism. Give amateurism the death penalty, then you have a chance at creating a system free of a lot of this corruption.
But the problems with the NCAA didn't begin on September 26th when those charges were announced.
The story of the NCAA is a story of power, money, and corruption. It's been going on for a long time. And it's the athletes and their families who get hurt.
I wake up in the middle of the night dreaming that I walk in the door and he's hanging. Or he shot himself because he's that depressed. You put trust in these universities. You trust them with your kid on and off the court. And once you're damaged good, they just kick you to the curb.
We've spent the past few months trying to figure out how the NCAA and amateurism went wrong. And can the system be fixed, or does it need to be dismantled?
Why in the world would we have football be a part of a college? What does that have to do with education?
Litigation hasn't worked. Organization hasn't worked. Legislation, there's no way it's going to work. So the only thing that was really left was competition.
I think we are in the midst of the tipping point. The question is, how far will it tip?